the drive to create things. You're a writer, a photographer, a musician, a maker. You're ready to make things happen.
But chasing creative isn't always easy. Your time and energy go to your work, your family, and your life. Is it really possible to make space for the creative in your everyday?
Here at the Chasing Creative Podcast, we believe you can. We're everyday creatives who have insights and action steps you can take today to make your creative plans happen.
I'm Ashley Brooks, a freelance writer and editor at Brooks Editorial and a work-at-home mom of three. I spend my creative time working on a novel and occasionally doing some knitting.
And I'm Abigail Krebs, the writer and photographer behind Inkwells and Images. I'm also a work-at-home mom of one, learning to balance work and home and trying to find a little bit of time to work on something just for fun.
And you're listening to the Chasing Creative Podcast.
Welcome back to the Chasing Creative Podcast. You've tuned into episode 5 of season 6, a season where we are chatting all about the ebbs and flows of the creative process. Today we've got Sarah Von Bargen here with us. She is the mastermind behind yesandyes.org, where she is a writer, coach, and educator who helps people spend their time, their money, and their energy on purpose. We wanted to have her on today to discuss how to craft goals that really matter to you, create habits that support those goals, and then what the ebbs and flows of the self-employed and creative life look for her personally. So thank you so much for joining us today, Sarah.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so I know Abby and I have both been following you for years, not to seem like stalkers at all, but we really love your work and we want to make sure that our listeners are familiar with you. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your journey from being an overseas ESL teacher to a self-employed creative person here in Minneapolis?
Yeah, so I started blogging when I moved back from overseas. I'd been living abroad for about 7 years. And I moved back, and my transition back into life in the U.S. was not super smooth. And I really wanted a creative outlet. And before I had been an ESL teacher, I'd written for newspapers, I'd worked at an ad agency. And so I had experience writing, and I had some experience in marketing, and I was reading blogs, and I thought, I can do this. Like, I have the skill set to do this. And also, I didn't see a lot of people writing the stuff that I wanted to read. So I thought, like, I'm just going to be the change that I want to see in the blogosphere. And so between sort of being lucky enough to come to the table with the deck stacked in my favor in terms of my skill set, I also got in at the right time. And also, for better or for worse, the way my brain is wired, I'm an INTJ, I'm an Enneagram 1, I'm a Virgo, I'm an eldest child, I'm of Scandinavian Germanic heritage. It combines to, like, just an absolute tenacious workhorse with a verging on problematic work ethic. which is kind of what you need to be successful in self-employment at first at the beginning. So I was all those things combined, and within about 2 years of blogging, I was making enough money blogging that it surpassed my income as an ESL teacher at a nonprofit, though let's be honest, I was making $16 an hour, so it wasn't really that hard to surpass it. And I was able to quit teaching and be a blogger full time.
That's awesome. And like you said, just the perfect blend of skill set and the time when blogs were taking off. Yes. It feels silly now to think like, oh, I've got this great blog idea that I want to start, because there's just so much chatter out there, but you really mm-hmm. were ahead of the curve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this question is a little bit self-serving, but we'd love to hear what you have to think, because we, as Ashley and I, discuss this pretty often. We're all three in the Midwest. So you and Ashley are both in Minneapolis, and I'm in Wisconsin, not too far from Madison. For us, for so long, Midwesterners have been kind of sold the lie that we need to relocate to, you know, Los Angeles or New York City in order to live a really cool and creative life. Did you ever have that moment in your own journey? And when did you realize that it was okay to stay put in Minneapolis?
I have never felt like that. I think partially because I grew up in a tiny resort town. I'm from Aiken, if that means anything to you, Ashley.
Yes.
So like, to me, like, I'm from a town that literally has one stoplight. So even to end up living in Minneapolis is, you know, mind-blowing. considering where I came from. So I never felt like just living in Minneapolis, that was enough for me. And also because I have traveled so extensively and because I lived abroad, I never particularly struggled with that. And because I have been blogging for so long and I have so many internet friends who are all around the world, and I've witnessed people become incredibly successful regardless of where they're located. So that's not something that I particularly struggled with. I think it might be a little bit more common, like if you're a YouTuber, maybe you feel like you need to move out to LA, or if you work, you know, in the agency world, or you wanna, or you're a videographer, or you're a musician. I can understand that inclination. But for me, because all of my work was pretty much exclusively internet-based, that is not something that I've ever struggled with.
Yeah, writers seem to have a little bit of an advantage there, where we can sort of take our work with us wherever we go, and it doesn't necessarily matter where you are. And Minneapolis, for what it's worth, does have a pretty happening art scene. Like there are a lot of people here who appreciate theater and art and literature, so I feel like we are really lucky in that regard. And maybe it's just sometimes when I travel to other bigger cities, they're like, oh, you're from Minnesota. There's nothing there except snow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, whenever anybody says that to me, I'm like, bless your heart. You can stay away from Minnesota, and we will keep our award-winning parks, our low cost of living, our great public schools. Like, good. Yes. Thank you. You're totally right. Don't come.
Yes. We don't need you.
Yes.
That's great. So I know throughout both of our creative journeys, Ashley and I have both discovered needing to really take a step back and define what we actually want our life to look like. And we found that that process is just as important as any kind of productivity hack to getting more done in a day. Getting the right things done in the day is more important to overall happiness. So how can our listeners, and Ashley and I too, use these new seasons of life to kind of build better habits than before?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. Well, one thing that I will say, so a lot of my work, so I teach classes and I do a lot of coaching around goals and habits and money, and pretty much everything that I do starts with, it. For a long time it started with the assumption that people understood what made them happy. So like, you know, I'm going to teach you how to spend money in a way that aligns with your happiness. I'm going to teach you how to build habits that will help make you happy. I'm going to help you pursue the goals that will make you happy, because I have always known what made me happy. So I just assumed that everybody else knew this. And what I discovered is that many, many people don't. So I thought I was starting at step one. I was not. I was really starting at step three. So I actually wrote, and recently, it's totally free, I put it on my website, a workbook called How to Figure Out What Makes You Happy, because many, many people don't know. And as you have experienced, and I in my own life have had some experiences of this as well, when you don't take the time to figure out what makes you happy, it is very, very, very easy and incredibly common to pursue goals, to build habits, to chase dreams that are not actually yours, that we haven't taken the time to consider. And then when you get there, you're like, oh my God, what? Like, I just spent tens of thousands of dollars on this and it does not feel the way I think it was going to feel. Or like, I just adopted this puppy, or like moved in with this partner, or moved across the country to go to this academic program, and I was mistaken. This is incredibly not for me. So I think all of this actually starts with figuring out what makes you happy and challenging the status quo to a certain extent, because otherwise it's really easy to spend years and tons of energy and tens of thousands of dollars pursuing something that ultimately is not actually right for you.
Yes, that is such a great explanation of that, and something that so many people don't stop and think about. Like you said, like even that word you used, aligning, like aligning what makes you happy with your values, or aligning your money with what makes you happy, is just not something that I think people give a whole lot of thought to in our current culture. You kind of just get funneled into, this is the next thing you're supposed to do. I mean, you're supposed to go to college, or you're supposed to go to grad school, or you're supposed to get married and have this big fancy wedding, and whatever it might be. And so how, you said you've always kind of known what made you happy. So how have you been able to encourage other people to do that same thing if it wasn't a process you needed to go through yourself? And then are there any common mistakes that you notice people making around choosing those goals that don't align with their values?
Gosh, well, I would say like 90% of the stuff in my life, I have been lucky or fortunate that I was like, I was right. Like, yes, this made me happy. I did it right. But I would say the one thing that I did that was not correct was I spent $18,000 and a year and a half getting a master's degree that did not serve me in my career field. And I mostly got it, like, I'm glad that I have the master's degree because I got it from the University of Victoria in Wellington, New Zealand, and I had a great time living in New Zealand and I met some lifelong friends, but that, like, that's why I'm glad I did it. You know, I was probably like 2 months into graduate school and I was like, this is not the right decision for me. But I had already, you know, spent the money. I had already moved to New Zealand. Like, I wasn't going to turn back. And the reason I went to graduate school was because a lot of my friends were doing it. And I was like, well, I'm totally as smart as they are. I was sort of at a crossroads in my career. And I found the thought of like doing a program where you get a certificate at the end very soothing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like that feels so much more soothing and more concrete than like, I'm just going to try and become a better teacher, or I'm going to teach myself how to code, or I'm going to like pitch a bunch of magazines and see if they'll take my writing. It is, as weird as it sounds, it's easier psychologically to find a graduate school program, send them all your paperwork, get accepted, and then move across the world. To me, that felt easier than like cobbling something together on my own. But I didn't stop and ask myself, like, does this make me happy? Do I really want to, am I so committed to being an ESL teacher that I want this master's degree? Or do I like being an ESL teacher because it gives me a way to live abroad? And the answer was, I liked being an ESL teacher because it gave me a way to live abroad. And you super don't need a master's degree in applied linguistics to teach English in Taiwan. You really, really don't. So I think that experience sort of made me, and that it cost $18,000. That's a very expensive mistake to make. Mm-hmm. But I know people who've made that mistake in terms of marriages, in terms of houses, boats, cars, you know, also going to graduate school, all sorts of stuff. And so having that experience made me sort of step back and think like, wow, I don't want this to happen again. I don't want to have another experience that I spend a year and a half of my life and this much money on and then get there and decide and discover that I was wrong. So that is sort of what sort of shook me up and made me realize that I needed to be much more intentional about these big choices I was making.
Yeah. So how do you encourage other people to kind of figure out what makes them happy and what goals are going to align with what they actually want to do in life? Like, what kind of questions do you ask, or what kind of exercises do you encourage them to do so that they can figure out if they're starting from that step one, I have no idea what's going to make me happy, but I need to figure it out. What do they do first?
Well, so the three exercises that I teach, and this is all in the free workbook, I'll send you guys a link so your listeners can download it. But number one, it just starts with noticing. Like, I literally have a notes app on my phone, and when I am happy, I make a note of it in my phone. And I try to be as specific as possible. Like, I am eating outside in beautiful weather. I am taking a walk around the lake with my friend in the middle of a weekday. I just had a conversation with a stranger that was really funny. I played with animals. I made a new recipe with my husband and it was really fun. So I literally just notice when I'm happy and I try to be as detailed as possible, because a lot of the times when we're vague, like, oh, travel makes me happy. But like, does waiting in line at the airport make you happy? No. Does like being in the middle seat in the airplane make you happy? Of course not. There's probably something really specific, like feeling anonymous in a new city, or you know, using your second language effectively, or trying new foods. So when you get really specific about it, when you notice it and you notice the specifics, it's easier to sort of replicate it and to find it in other areas in your life. So I love exploring new places, and I'm going to Marrakesh in 3 weeks, and that will feel great. But truly, I can also honestly have just almost as much happiness from exploring some small town in Minnesota that I've never been to. I know that sounds silly, but it's true, because to me, it's the novelty that's exciting. I don't have to fly thousands and thousands of miles to have that experience. So I would say, number one, just notice it and be really specific. Number two, think back about the things that made you happy in like second and third and fourth grade before you were concerned about like what was cool. Was this monetizable? Was this hobby expensive? Am I going to make the varsity team? Like, when it was just you and like your siblings and your neighbors like dinking around, what were you doing? Were you like choreographing dances in the basement? Were you drawing? Were you, you know, trying to start a babysitter's club? Like, what were you doing? Because before you were so influenced by what you quote unquote should be doing, that stuff probably still makes you happy. And there is almost surely an adult version of it. You can join, you know, the community ed theater production. You can join a choir. You can try new recipes. Like, you can join the community band and play your harmonica or whatever. Like, there is an adult version for that. And the last thing that I do, and when I shared this, I have a free private Facebook group. And when I shared this with them, somebody said, no joke, this saved me 2 or 3 therapy sessions. So I have you write down the people in your life who are sort of the most important people in life. So maybe your partner, your siblings, your parents, your best friends, your roommate, people who you spend a lot of time with. You write down all of the things that you perceive make them happy. Like, what are their hobbies? What makes them happy? What makes them proud? And these can be activities, TV shows, anything. So you write down all the stuff that makes them happy, and then you go through and you literally cross everything off the list that does not make you happy. Because it is very, very, very easy to absorb that stuff. And we don't even stop and think like, yeah, my mom likes gardening, but do I? Like, so when you see it written down, like, go through that list item by item and really ask yourself, you know, if you hadn't seen somebody doing this, would you be doing it? Would you want to do this? My friends love beer and they love riding bikes. I don't like either of those things. I don't mind riding a bike on like the Greenway, but riding a bike like on the street and going to a brewery is my personal version of hell. But it took me quite a while to like figure that out, because everybody I knew loved doing it and it seems like such a cool thing to do, and I extremely don't want to do it. But because everybody around me was doing it, I did it.
Yeah, that sounds like such an amazing way to really narrow down what you care about, not just what everybody else around you or everybody that you're seeing on Instagram cares about mm-hmm. and is doing. And we will for sure link to that download in our show notes so that everybody can work through those exercises for themselves. So once people have identified what makes them happy and those goals that they want to pursue, what tips do you have to change your habits so that they're actually supporting those new goals and helping you reach whatever milestone it is that you want to reach, whether you want to be more creative or travel more or whatever it might be? How do you create habits that support those things?
Well, one of the things that I tell people, and nobody wants to hear this, is that you can only take on one habit at a time. And also, it takes so much longer to change habits than we've been told. Like, on January 1st, you're going to see all of those magazine articles about, like, 21 days to a new you. Psychologists have proven that it takes somewhere between 12 to 265 days to change a habit, with the average being 65 days. So that's almost 3 times longer than we've been told.
Yes, it is.
So I wish that everybody knew that, because a lot of people, you know, they'll do something for 21 days and then when it hasn't stuck, they get down on themselves. I'm not good at this. I can't do this. Everybody else is good at this, but I'm not. And they give up when truly they're only a third of the way there. So number one, habit change takes a lot longer than you think it does. And number two, you should only take on one habit at a time. The way I say it is that we have a limited amount of self-control or decision-making juice in our brains. The real term for this is ego depletion and decision fatigue. But it's true. Like, humans have a limited amount of decision, of like good, healthy, self-control-based decision-making they can engage in a day. And there's also a limited amount of self-control that we have over the course of a day. And I'm sure that we have all witnessed this in our life. You know, you're trying not to like stalk your ex on Instagram and everything's going fine until 9 p.m. Or you're trying to eat healthy and everything's fine until 8:30 when, you know, after you've been worn down by all day, you know, like avoiding the sweets and avoiding the Cheetos. And then at 9:30, everything falls apart. And so when you're asking too much of yourself, when you're trying to change 17 habits all at once and you think you're going to be able to do it in 3 weeks, you are creating incredibly unrealistic expectations and you're very, very likely to fail, which is only going to reinforce your self-narrative that you're not good at this stuff. So only take on one habit change at a time and realize that it's honestly about it's going to take you realistically about 2 months, potentially maybe even more, to change that habit.
Wow, that is really interesting. I have not heard the 65-day average before. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it's usually like 21 days or 30 days or 28 mm-hmm. days or whatever it happens to be. And I suppose it probably depends too on the kind of habit you're trying to change.
Yes.
If you're trying to overhaul your entire like way that you eat food, that's going to take a little bit longer than I am no longer going to check Instagram first thing when I wake up in the morning.
Yes, yes. And I also tell my students, so I have a course where I teach all of this called Habit School. And I also tell them, really make for sure that you are only taking on one habit, and like being healthier is not a habit. Like eating a salad for lunch 5 days a week, every time you go to work, that is a habit. Drinking a glass of water before every meal, that is a habit. Going for a walk every morning, that is a habit. Stretching before you go to bed, that's a habit. But like, do not take on all four of those at once and try and lump it under the heading of being healthier, because again, you're going to fail and then you're going to feel bad about yourself. And you shouldn't. It's hard. It's hard to take on all that stuff. Only do one at a time so you can set yourself up for success. And also, just because you change habit A in 65 days, rather depressingly, it doesn't mean you're going to change habit B in 65 days. Like, it might take like 150 days for habit B. It varies from habit to habit and person to person. So, you know, if you stop smoking in 21 days, that doesn't mean you're going to be able to stop Instagram in 21 days.
Yes, that is, again, really solid advice for people, I think, because we are recording this in September, but this podcast is airing in December when people are thinking about the new year and they're all optimistic about their fresh slates and their resolutions, and they are getting sucked into those magazine articles about how to totally change themselves and be a new person. And we are curious about how you might use a new season in life, like it could be a new job, it could be the start of the new year or the new school year, being newly single, anything that sort of signifies that new season of life for you. How can you use those times to springboard that jumping into new habits and that maybe even reevaluating what makes you happy? And if what made you happy previously, you know, last year or 2 years or 5 years mm-hmm. ago, if that's still the thing that makes you happy right now, and if that's still the thing that you want to move toward in the new year.
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. And I love using new seasons or life changes as an opportunity to reevaluate this stuff. And it's been shown that this is one of the easiest times to make new changes. So I would think about, like, let's say that you have a new job. And let's say that there are like 7 habits that you want to change. Think about what is a habit that would be like easiest to tie into this. So let's say you want to be healthier. Maybe at this new job, you're going to walk you have an option where you can like walk every lunch hour, regardless of the weather, or you are going to start showing up on time, or you are going to bring your lunch every day so you save money, or you are going to not trash talk about all your coworkers. But think about what is one habit that would be easiest to sort of roll into this life change. Like if you are now living by yourself and you used to live with a partner, could you change a habit related to like how clean you keep your space, or when you go to bed, or even like the sort of food you cook for yourself. Think about a habit change that would be easiest to roll into this. And know also that there's a ripple effect with all of this. So if you start walking every day during lunch, you're going to sleep better. You're probably going to feel calmer, and it will be eventually easier to make other changes that will affect the rest of your life. So don't feel like, you know, somehow you're not taking on something big enough just by making one small habit change in one area of your life, because the way it can affect the rest of your life is truly amazing.
Yeah, that is a really good point about the ripple effect, because I went through a lot of this about a year ago when I was diagnosed with pretty severe anxiety, and I had this big checklist of items it felt like that I was supposed to be doing. Like, my chiropractor wanted me to be doing these stretches, and my therapist wanted me to be doing this meditation, and my doctor was like, you need to exercise more, and you need to, you know, the naturopath was like, you have to take all these vitamins and eat better nutrition. Gosh. And it just felt like it was contributing to the anxiety for a while, because I was like, this is so much stuff I have to do, and I'm already barely functioning, you know? And it took a little bit to get over that hump, where I think I ended up starting with the meditation because that was where I noticed the most results right away. And then I added in taking vitamins because that was relatively easy. And after a couple of months, I looked up and was like, oh, this no longer feels like so much work, because now I'm sleeping better. And because I'm sleeping better, I'm able to concentrate more. And like you said, it just sort of snowballs forward. And that's a really good point that I think people forget and overlook sometimes when they're facing a lot of change. So I'm really glad that you brought that up for people. And then, because the season of our podcast is all about sort of ups and downs in our creative lives and in our professional lives, and we are curious about if you experience any of those typical ebbs and flows in life tied to either the physical seasons of the year or different work projects wrapping up, or your different travel schedules, because you go so many places during the year. And how do you sort of handle those ups and downs of life?
Oh gosh, that is a great question. I would say, rather obviously, it starts with just being gentle with myself and trying to remember. My friend Nicole Antoinette always talks about how, like, I'm not a robot. Like, you're not a robot. Mm-hmm. It's not fair or realistic to expect the exact same output from ourselves and our brains and our psyches every single day. I'm not a machine. So I think also knowing my own work styles and understanding, like, how much I can realistically expect from myself. So, you know, I can do maybe 3 or 4 hours of, like, hardcore creative writing a day, but then, like, the rest of it just needs to be, like, doing admin and, like, formatting images and replying to emails and stuff. And knowing that about myself is really important, because if I expected myself to do really hardcore, in-depth, emotional, psychological writing for 8 hours, it would be really easy to be disappointed in myself when I couldn't produce that. So I think just understanding myself, and that's been very much trial and error, knowing myself and my working styles well enough to know that. And I think to a certain extent, just building a business that allows for that, you know, that has a certain amount of passive income, that has a certain amount of ongoing clients, so that even if I am traveling, or, you know, if I get sick, or for some reason I'm just not able to work as much as usual, like, there's still money coming in, so I don't need to burn myself out writing stuff and posting things constantly when, you know, a family member's in the hospital. So I think it's a combination of just, you know, very intentionally building a business to navigate those ebbs and flows with many, many different income streams, and also having plenty of trial and error to know myself well enough to know what works for my brain.
Yeah, that is smart, being able to kind of build in some almost like premeditated margin for yourself, mm-hmm. for those times when you know you're not going to be able to be in tip-top shape or whatever. I know I've been sick with a cold, like a nasty summer head cold, for 3 solid weeks now. And I haven't gotten much done at all work-wise, but mm-hmm. I'd already been working ahead on things, so I don't feel crunched. I still feel mm-hmm. a little behind, but I'm not panicking yet. So I think building in those natural margins for yourself are really important. And like you said, we're not robots. I know Ashley and I mm-hmm. were just talking a couple of episodes ago about the idea even of creativity and our output being tied to like our menstrual cycles as women.
Oh yes.
As opposed to men who don't experience those hormone cycles on a monthly basis. Yeah. So mm-hmm. just kind of recognizing like, hey, we don't have to live the exact same day every day of our lives in order to be successful.
Yes.
I feel like I've learned a lot, honestly, and now I'm like, okay, when's the beginning of the year now so we can get going on some of this? This is great.
Yeah, going to go make lists about what makes us happy.
Yes.
Definitely. I know Ashley and I both just very recently low-key started working through, is it The Artist's Way? I'm going to call it the wrong thing.
Yeah, it's The Artist's Way.
I always want to call it The Artist's Journey and not The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. Have you ever cracked that one, Sarah?
I have not, but okay. That's where the idea of morning pages comes mm-hmm. from, yep. right?
Yes. And now I completely lost my train of thought, and it's gone. Oh, no. So one of the things she wants you to do the morning pages every day, and every week she wants you to take yourself on a quote-unquote artist date where mm-hmm. you just have fun, which sounds really intriguing, but as someone mm-hmm. who is very driven by productivity, like, I can't figure out what to do for an artist date that isn't in some way, shape, or form tied to work or crossing something else off my list. So I feel like this would be almost a good exercise. Finding out what makes me happy would tie in well to what on earth does an artist date look like for me as opposed to somebody else.
Yes. And one of the things that I actually teach, this is going to sound counterintuitive, but I actually teach a concept like this in my money class, Bank Boost. So one of the things we talk about in Bank Boost is really spending your money with intention. Mm-hmm. We put everyone figures out what their, I call it your fun budget. And this is the amount of money that you get to spend every week guilt-free on things that bring you fun. And on Sunday, we all plan for the coming week where our money is going to go. So you have something to look forward to. You have that spending to look forward to because studies have shown that you get 30% of your enjoyment of an experience from anticipating it. And also, when you know where your money is going, you're much less likely to overspend. And so when we do the work of figuring out what makes us happy and then literally scheduling it into your calendar and knowing how much money you're going to spend on it, it sounds silly, but it's amazing how effective it is. And it's amazing how much joy it brings to your life, knowing that on Thursday you're going to get a pedicure with your friend or on Friday you're going to that matinee. It's really amazing what a difference it can make.
Yeah, and it might sound counterintuitive to talk about like scheduling how you're going to spend your money, but that's amazing. Like, even as you're talking about that, I was reminded of an idea that I got from Laura Vanderkam, who writes a lot about she writes a lot about like different productivity and time management kind of things. She's fantastic. And I can't remember which book of hers this idea is in, but she talks about that, how anticipation makes an experience so much better. And then being able to remember an experience is also part of that enjoyment that you get from it. But actually doing the thing sometimes isn't as great as we think it's going to be. So building that anticipation in is a really, really smart idea to get the most bang for your buck, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you have a budget that you're working within, you are also, I tell my Bank Boost students that you should aim to have at least three things in your week that you've scheduled to look forward to. And the thing is, they don't all have to cost money. Like, one of my favorite friend dates is walking around Lake Nokomis. It costs $0. Or walking on Grand Avenue and just going into shops and looking at things. That costs $0. We have a state park pass. Taking a friend and their dog and going for a hike costs $0. And all those things are really fun and they absolutely make me happy.
Yeah. I just listened to a podcast that I will drop into our show notes as well, and it was about self-care based on your Enneagram number. And that was, yeah, and that was actually what the expert being interviewed said was, for ones, which you are, Sarah, was you need to schedule spontaneity into your week, like time that you can just let yourself go wild. And I thought that was so interesting. But I'm a five and also an INTJ. And so I feel like there's a lot of similarities between my one friends in the way that, like, I am very much ruled by lists and deadlines and timelines and things like that. And I really do have to, like, plan downtime in order to, like, let myself enjoy it. So I could totally see where scheduling out how you're going to spend your money and how you're going to be happy when you spend that money makes a big difference on even just your day-to-day and anticipation happiness. Yeah. Especially if you can do it midweek when you think you're supposed to be working, but it feels like you're cheating the system. So.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. One of the common denominators in the stuff that makes me happy is, I call it being smug, but I'm sure there's like a more diplomatic, but like doing something at a time of day or week or even time of year when it is not available to other people is one of my absolute favorite things. So going to a midday, midweek matinee, I love it. Going out to eat in the middle of the day, I love it. Traveling during the off season, I love it. You know, flying midweek, anything that I feel like I'm getting away mm-hmm. with something, or mm-hmm. like if I get a, or if I like cobble together a trip that I get really a lot cheaper than it should be because I'm, you know, using points and affiliate links and, you know, I'm going to this conference and they paid for my flight. That makes me really happy. So any sort of thing that kind of makes me feel like, ooh, I pulled one over on somebody, or ooh, I'm being so clever with this. That's one of the things that makes me really happy. And now that I know that about myself, it's a lot easier to like find those little pockets of joy.
That's amazing. And I bet that's something that is so specific that you probably wouldn't have noticed it if you hadn't been paying like super careful attention, like you mentioned earlier in the episode.
Yes. Yeah. Like, and it's funny because now that I know that, I can replicate it. Like, maybe you guys have heard me talk about how I love the free section on Nextdoor.com. I will not shut up about it. It's amazing. If you just wait long enough, anything you want will show up on Nextdoor. And it's that same thing of, like, feeling like I got, you know, like I scammed the system. Like, we have a beautiful sleeper sofa that we got for free on Nextdoor. Like, people constantly come into my house, compliment me on everything, and then I won't shut up about how it's either free from Nextdoor or a thrift store or Goodwill or something. And it's that same feeling of like, I figured out a way around, you know, the thing that everybody thought I should do, and I got it my way without like having to like give in.
That's the best.
It is. Awesome. 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 Well, I know one of the things that makes Ashley and I both really, really happy, and we know this about ourselves, is reading. And I think you are a reader too, aren't you, Sarah?
Yeah. Oh, I'm a voracious. I read two books at all times.
Excellent. Excellent. So we were just kind of curious. At the end of every episode, we do what we call mini book club. Would you care to share with our listeners either what you've been reading lately or even a book or two or more, you can have as many as you want, that have really helped you significantly with your own goal setting or personal development?
Yeah. So right now I'm reading, this is totally fault. I'm like a late adopter. I'm reading The Bean Trees for the first time, which if anybody's listening, that book is literally 20 years old. It's taught in schools like all over the U.S., but it's Barbara Kingsolver's first novel, I believe. It is phenomenal. It is extremely readable. It's fun. It's sweet. But I think it is particularly incredibly, incredibly timely. If you are on the fence about asylum, immigration, the southern border, you know, like whether or not we should let people into our country if they can't 100% financially support themselves, If you don't really understand it, or if you're kind of on the fence about it, I really, really, really encourage you to read this book. And again, it's a very lovely, readable novel. It's not some like dry nonfiction thing about immigration policy. It's a beautiful novel. It's fantastic. Like, I was already like laughing out loud and like half crying this morning reading it. So that is the book that I am reading right now that I really love. I also just finished Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk. which is a great novel about a woman who is, I think she's like 90, and she was, it's a novel, and she was America's highest paid advertising copywriter in like the 1940s. And it's set in the 1980s New York, and it's on New Year's Eve, and she decides to like walk all over Manhattan and sort of revisit areas that were meaningful to her. And she runs into a bunch of people and has a bunch of experiences. And it's, you know, sort of like a slow, gentle book, but it's also, you know, a really good look at history and feminism and identity and career and all sorts of good stuff. But again, very readable.
Oh, those both sound really good. I have not read that particular Barbara Kingsolver novel, but I have read others of hers.
Oh my God, it's so good. It is so, you just can't even stand it. Like, it's just so good. Ugh, it's great.
And she's an amazing writer. So yes. I can imagine, like, hearing your enthusiasm, I'm like, okay, I have to get it. Because I know how well she writes.
Yeah. So what about you, Ashley? Have you been reading anything really good lately?
Yes, so I recently finished a collection of essays called I Miss You When I Blink by Mary Laura Philpott. And this is a newer release, so people have probably seen it around. And I'm just here to say that it is 100% worth the hype. Mm. She is such a delightful writer. I mean, these essays had me laughing out loud, which I rarely do when I read books. And they are so funny and so relatable. And it almost ties in as like a memoir. I mean, they're so well connected and so well edited that it's just almost like this exploration of the author's entire womanhood. And I love it so much. I think everybody should read it.
Oh, cool. That does sound really good. And I know you've recommended it to me before offline. So now I definitely just need to add it to my list.
Yes, it was delightful. Yeah. So what have you been reading?
Yeah, I have not been reading too much while sick, sadly. But I just finished, and I'm a little late to the game, Michelle Obama's memoir called Becoming, which I'm sure everyone has heard about at this point. But I really liked it. Memoir is not usually my genre, and it was really long. Like, I did not expect it to be like 450 pages going in because I picked up the Kindle version. But I thought she did a really great job in giving you the whole overview of her entire life so far, which has included a lot, without getting bogged down in details, which I think a lot of, I'm going to say historical memoir really tends to do. And I mean, in some ways, her memoir is definitely historical in the fact that she is Michelle Obama. So I thought it was a really well done book, in addition to being just, I mean, she's just a really cool person. So I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, excellent. We got some really great book recommendations for everybody to add to their list heading into the new year here. So thank you again so much for chatting with us, Sarah. And before we go, we would love for you to tell our listeners where they can find you online and where they can access all those great resources that you were mentioning today that we will link to in the show notes.
Wonderful. So my website is yesandyes.org. You can find me on all social media under the name Yes and Yes Blog. I'm on Instagram stories almost every day. Yeah, and if you go to Yes and Yes Blog, you will be able to find and download the How to Figure Out What Makes You Happy workbook. It is totally free. And as I said, one woman said that it was worth 2 to 3 therapy sessions. So that's like, to me, that's like the biggest, that's the best thing that somebody could say about anything that I've created.
Yep, that's some good value right there. So everyone should check out the show notes and head over to find Sarah online. And thank you so much for chatting with us today. It was great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Chasing Creative Podcast. If you like what you heard in this episode, be sure to stop by chasingcreative.com to check out the show notes, catch up on past episodes, and subscribe to the podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also join in the creative conversation by finding us on Instagram at Abigail E. Krebs or at Ashley Brooks Writes, or by using the hashtag ChasingCreative on Twitter or Instagram.
If you have any feedback for us, drop us a line at chasingcreativepodcast@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, go chase what makes you creative.